Our next case is 10-1925, State of Ohio versus Daniel Ginley. Ms. Moran? Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court, Matthew Meyer on behalf of the appellant, the State of Ohio, in this case. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I could. Your Honors, in 5 days, it will have been 15 years since this court decided State versus Bush in 1996, a case which I believe is the high water mark for the type of care and concern that domestic violence prosecutions should receive in Ohio's justice system. And it's against the cautionary language in that case that I measure what I believe is the failure of discretion in the courts below in this case. And I believe this case is a prime example of the type of problems that prosecutors face when they execute the General Assembly's wishes to bring these cases on behalf of victims who, in a large majority of the cases, fight with prosecutors and do not want these prosecutions actually to result in guilty verdicts. In this case, the facts, I think, are very important in analyzing the proposition of law that we've asked this court to adopt. The victim in this case has a long history of abuse with her cohabitating partner, as we've alleged, Mr. Ginley. In addition to this case, Mr. Ginley was named as the defendant in a 2009 case, which, again, Ms. Mathis was named as the complaining witness. And in that case, she didn't show up so many times that the case was ultimately dismissed. Then when she came forward in this case, we again brought a domestic violence indictment alleging multiple acts of domestic violence, kidnapping, felonious assault. And we found that about 3 months after the arrest, the victim showed up to court and announced that she no longer wanted to cooperate with the prosecution. She obtained a lawyer, refused to even speak with the prosecutor, and announced that everything that she had told the police was in fact wrong, and that if called to testify, she would repudiate all of those details. A statement which I would add was made in her own handwriting, alleging very detailed acts of abuse, some of which the police officer actually observed himself. She had a bruise on her cheek, which she alleged had been put there 2 months prior by Mr. Ginley. And so in the face of this very difficult situation, the state asked the trial court to allow it to call Ms. Mathis as a court's witness. And in that situation, if the state were to proceed without that procedure, there's very little the prosecutor can do calling Ms. Mathis as its own witness. Once she gets on the stand and gives her current repudiation of the allegations, we're essentially stuck with the answers.
And you want us to say what?
I'm asking this court to, in the context of domestic violence prosecutions specifically, and I think that's very important, but to find that Evidence Rule 614A, the court's witness rule, does not require, in fact, should not require, evidence of a threat. In essence, what the trial court did here, and why I think this court should announce this proposition, is to say that the facts of this case are not enough.
Okay. Are you content to have the trial judge have absolute discretion when there is a request, whether to grant it or not?
Well, I think that discretion has to be measured against the legal requirements.
It seems like you want us to set up a standard for which the trial court has no discretion.
No, I respectfully disagree. And the standard I'm asking this court to adopt is in the rule itself. The staff committee notes to 614A say that the purpose of this rule is to allow the trial court to exercise its duty to achieve the truth. And balancing the rights of accuser and accused, that should be the goal here. And what we've got in this case is a trial judge who believes that Evidence Rule 614A is essentially a rule of forfeiture, requiring the prosecutor to specifically demonstrate a quid pro quo on the part of the defendant to actually cause the recantation. And it's been suggested by my colleagues for the defense and for the amicus that, in fact, that's taking it out of context. But that's the only discernible legal principle I can draw from this record, because what the trial court did say was, number one, these facts are not enough, and number two, the state should show a threat that caused the recantation. And the rule of forfeiture described by the United States Supreme Court in Crawford versus Washington is one where the defendant forfeits the right to challenge hearsay when the defendant has killed the witness. And that's, I think, just the wrong standard we need to apply here. The question the trial court should have asked, can this assist the fact finder in achieving the truth?
More often than not, when this kind of problem arises, it is that the person who called the police, put in the call, or a 911 call, wanted and needed, perhaps, probably, law enforcement intervention to protect that person on the spot. But upon reflection, or intimidation, and it would run the range, decides, I don't want this to go forward. It's not in my own best interest for it to go forward. Isn't that the problem that you have with these?
It is a problem we have had.
And some decide that because of threats, and others decide that because they realize maybe they were both drunked up at the time and they've sobered up and healed the problem, or at least they think they have.
There may be no explicit threat. There's a whole range of reasons why victims do this. There may be financial ties between the victim and the defendant. There may be children to think about. And they may just emotionally not want to separate with that person. Be that as it may, though, we have a job that the General Assembly's given us. And the options that the trial court gave us are not good. I'm proposing they're unacceptable, in fact. And that's why Supreme Court review in this case could assist us in that job. And basically, the trial court dared us to go forward knowing that we can't prove our case.
Because was there a police report in this case?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Was there a police report in this case?
Yes, there was.
Could the officer have testified?
I guess, as a point of clarification, are you asking if the police officer could testify in a motion hearing or in the case in chief?
Well, I guess what I'm thinking is I thought there was a hospital report and a police report.
Well, if we're talking about the case in chief, yes, the officer could testify about the officer's own observations. And certainly, I think in the wake of the United States Supreme Court case in Davis, an ongoing emergency could justify officer's testimony about what the victim said within the limits of the hearsay rules. But what I'm suggesting is we should not have to go forward on domestic violence prosecutions without the testimony of the victim. That is always going to be what the state needs to prove its case. And to tell the state that it should proceed on tenuous hearsay grounds, I think is missing the point of this case.
Counsel, the threat or the language that the trial court judge used, are you saying that now that is going to be the rule in Cuyahoga County, that a judge will not do a 614 not utilize 614 because there's no threat that can be demonstrated by the prosecutor?
I believe it was certainly the rule that this particular trial judge used. And in seeking review in the 8th District, discretionary review, we asked the 8th District to clarify that point. We have 50 prosecutors who on a daily basis prosecute scores of these cases.
And are you saying that if the victim does not testify, your office will not take it to trial?
Well, if we're left with the status quo, which I'm suggesting is unacceptable, go forward on a case where the prosecutor knows that the victim recantation will almost guarantee an acquittal versus simply walk away from the case and let whatever happens, happens. I'm suggesting that the better rule is to explain to Ohio's trial judges that this should be the option in the careful exercise of discretion that this court described in Bush.
You want us to say this should be the option, that trial judges, you should employ Rule 614 when you have a recanting victim.
Absolutely. And if ever there was an evidence rule that was tailor-made to help us combat this situation, it's Evidence Rule 614.
And what does that do to judicial discretion if there's a proclamation from the Supreme Court to trial judges saying you should use 614 in recantation circumstances?
The question that Ohio's trial judges need to answer in the face of such a holding would be, can this assist the fact finder in establishing the truth? Is the victim's recantation actually genuine? Hold a hearing on that point. Insist the trial judges obtain testimony from the victim on that point, but the measure has to be the truth, not a threat. And if
let me ask you, speaking about threats, do you prosecute women who do this, victims who recant, and get in the way of successful prosecution of a defendant?
That suggestion was made by defense counsel on the record of this case, and in a sideways way by the trial court itself. And no, the answer is no. That is not justice.
But what would happen if you did? Would that be an even stronger message to the victims that when you make a report of domestic violence and you are injured and you set the wheels in motion for the intervention of the legal system, that you are subject to prosecution if you are, as this person is in this situation? I know it's got some competing interests with a chilling effect, et cetera. But, you know, I'm a little concerned that what you're asking us to do, and there's remedies that you could employ within your office to go forward on these cases.
Well, the alternatives are not good here. As I've suggested, dismiss the case and walk away. And in my memorandum in support, I brought up the Tanya Hunter-Lyons case, where a woman was warned by a judge not to go back to her abusive husband. Then she was stabbed 17 times and became a homicide case. That we are tasked with the General Assembly's intent in bringing these difficult prosecutions. And in deciding whether a victim should be prosecuted, I don't think that's the General Assembly's intent here. We have a difficult job to do when a victim says, do not go forward, what I said to the police is a lie. But we must do it according to the General Assembly in the recognition that these are the types of
cases.
That's
why you employ other tools, the police officer's statements and testimony, what they've observed, photographs that are taken simultaneously with the report, medical testimony, neighbors, you know, whatever you have to employ, you don't necessarily need to put the victim on the stand.
Some cases certainly can be brought without victim testimony, certainly. A large majority of them, however, cannot. A large majority of them need the testimony of the people who actually saw and experienced what happened. And those people are going to be the victim and the accused, provided the truthfulness of the allegations.
Mr. Meyer, is there any reason why this remedy that you're seeking can't be met through a change in the rule, in the evidence rule? Because right now, the evidence rule regarding whether the court should make someone a witness on its own, it's totally discretionary. The court may. And here we have a situation where the judge said what he said. And if we're looking at this as an abuse of discretion, you wish us to say that the statement the court made was an abuse of discretion? It was an abuse of discretion to talk about the threat? I'm having a difficult time in how you're suggesting that the court acted inappropriately.
2 points in response to that question, Your Honor. Specifically as to this case, I believe that an abuse of discretion can never, or an act within the court's discretion can never be founded on an outright error of law. And the idea that prosecutors have to show a quid pro quo threat before the trial court will apply 614A is not in the statute. There is no case law that says that is a criterion. The case that the trial court cited, those were the factual circumstances of the case, but nowhere in that State versus Curry opinion did the 8th District say that is a criterion by which you measure application of the rule. So the rule itself, I believe, provides the guidepost, and the guidepost should be truth. What is necessary here is a Supreme Court opinion, I believe, explaining in a proposition of law that the trial court needs to decide whether this rule can actually assist the fact finder in achieving the truth, not whether there is a forfeiture. And I believe it is in that important public policy that I've identified that this case transcends the simple notion of error correction. This case is representative of so many of these domestic violence cases. And if we are left with the status quo, as I've suggested, the answer is, I believe, that the prosecutor should just dismiss and walk away in this situation.
We could have a rule of evidence that takes care of that and specifically talks about domestic relations cases and recanting witnesses. Could we not?
Yes, absolutely. But that does not solve the problem we've identified now. And we have hundreds of cases in the meantime to worry about where this is a routine occurrence. I won't say all of the cases involve this situation, but a large number of them.
Mr. Meyer, the opposing counsel advances the idea that the case should be improvidently allowed because the Court of Appeals simply denied a motion for leave to appeal. Would you address that before you sit down?
Certainly. A couple points in response, Your Honor. I believe that in the treatment of this case by the 8th District, similar to the treatment of the case by the trial court, you had a lack of care and concern that this court in Bush said needs to be applied in domestic violence cases. Specifically, the 8th District said the state may only bring Criminal Rule 12K appeals, and any other appeal is moot. That is the actual journal entry that the 8th District announced in this case, and that is not the law. Revised Code 2945-67A says the state may appeal any other decision other than the four enumerated classes of appeals by right. And then you have to look at Revised Code Section 2505-02B1. Is this a final appealable order? And I am suggesting to this court, as I did to the 8th District, that the order in this case, even though interlocutory in nature, in effect determine the action. We've got a substantial right on the people
because
of the state.
Because your view is you wouldn't be able to use medical testimony or the police statements in order to obtain a conviction?
In this case, I believe we would not obtain a conviction without Ms. Mathis' testimony about what occurred in all of these incidents.
It was essential to the case.
It is essential to the case.
And if the case would go back to the trial court, without that testimony, your supposition is the court would dismiss the case and acquit the defendant, and then the state would not have an appeal.
I wonder aloud whether the prosecutor should simply dismiss in that case, knowing that the case is unprovable. And that is not certainly what should happen. That is not justice, and that is bad public policy for Ohio. But in terms of the 8th District,
how many of these kinds of cases do you see in the course of a year in Cuyahoga County?
Certainly more than dozens. I believe it's in the order of hundreds. Certainly more than dozens. I believe it's in the order of hundreds of cases. And this phenomenon
in Cuyahoga County.
In Cuyahoga County alone. And this phenomenon of victim recantation, I would say, occurs certainly in more than half. A large number, to my anecdotal knowledge of these cases, involve victims saying, I do not want to go forward. I will not participate in your prosecution. And oftentimes, as Ms. Mathis did in the first prosecution, they just don't show up.
What good does a rule do that we indicate to trial judges across Ohio, you may consider a 614 motion for a witness to be called as the court's witness without a finding that there's been a threat or an implied threat given to that witness?
I think it will do two things that would avoid what happened in this case, which I believe is a failure of justice. First, it's to recognize, as this court did 15 years ago in Bush, that domestic violence cases are fundamentally different due to this unique relationship between abuser and victim. And second, that there are tools that the legal system has to combat the problem of proceeding with prosecutions against victim wishes where, in the facts of the case, it is necessary. Evidence Rule 614A, which has as its guidepost the fundamental duty to find the truth, is the rule that courts should examine carefully. And if you examine what happened in this case against Bush, I believe you have a lack of care and concern, both by the 8th District and by the trial court.
Am I missing it, or is the only import of calling this witness as a court's witness to permit the state to cross-examine the witness using the statements that have been made either to the medical authorities or to the police department? Or is there something beyond that?
Well, it is the ability to at least try at the hands of a skillful examiner to obtain truthful answers by confronting the victim with their prior statement to the police, which is going to be diametrically opposed to the recantation, and asking them to explain the circumstances of the recantation.
And then would those statements possibly be admitted and submitted to the jury?
The statements themselves would have to the out-of-court statement would have to first satisfy any confrontation concerns and, I believe, hearsay concerns. In the situation where there's a failure of memory, that the recantation forms the failure of memory, certainly, I believe, Evidence Rule 813 would allow that statement to come in as a prior recorded recollection. In the situation where the prosecutor's goal is just to shake the victim off of their new position by the confrontation with the prior statements, and in the hope that the victim will acknowledge under oath in this crucible of cross-examination, what is the truth, it gives the prosecutor the tool to at least try. And that's not what happened in this case.
But isn't the reality under Crawford versus Washington, without the ability to put her on the stand, your prosecution is done? Since the United States Supreme Court has said that he has a right, the defendant has a right, to confront the witness, regardless of the testimonial statements that she made to the police at the hospital, those statements don't come in unless she is there subject to cross-examination or is otherwise deemed unavailable.
My answer to that question is generally yes, that is the case. There are, like I've said, a few circumstances where the victim's testimony is alone not necessary because there's neutral witnesses who themselves witnessed the abuse. Or there is a hearsay exception, such as the ongoing emergency coupled with some specific rule enumerated.
Facts here.
I do not believe that is the facts here, and I don't believe that's what happens in most cases.
Counsel, before you sit down, could you enlighten us as to what the requirements are under the law and what the practice is in Cuyahoga County with respect to, you get a 911 call comes in from, say, a spouse or girlfriend or whatever, and the police officers come out, and let's assume that there's less abuse than you say you have in this case, but there's some, he threw something at her, he threw a beer can at her, something. The damage is minor, but there's been an altercation. What options do the police have at that point? Are they required to arrest him under the law and or the practice, or do they have some discretion?
Well, Cuyahoga County has dozens of police departments, each with their own individual policies. But I think what happened in this case is typical of the scenario. If the police themselves are satisfied there is probable cause, and there, in this case specifically, there was a threat to the victim, Mr. Ginley was threatening to show up at her work to get her after making all of these threats to kill, the police will immediately arrest the defendant. And that is typical of the scenario. And then
what I'm asking is if it's less aggravated than you have in this case, but there's been some fight, altercation. Maybe it's not that physical, but they're yelling and screaming and somebody threw something at somebody. Do the police have any option, or are they required under the law to make an arrest, and does that start a prosecution for which there is no way out other than the complaining witness to say, I'm not coming to testify?
I believe police do have some discretion in this regard.
Yes or no?
Yes, the answer is yes. And I also believe that both prosecutors and trial judges, as this court explained in Bush, also have discretion. There is a filter to say to those cases where, in fact, the allegations do not appear to be true and there is no ongoing threat.
I'm saying there was something happened. Some act of that could have caused injury, didn't cause much, but something happened. Somebody threw something at somebody. Any options there?
I believe the police have the option themselves to pursue the charges, yes. I believe prosecutors as well have the option to pursue the charges.
But on the site, is there a preferred arrest policy where an officer is going to show up at a domestic call and he says his side of the story, she says hers, they have to make a decision on the spot, who's going to jail, who's going to be arrested?
In most cases,
that's not the situation that officers are confronted with.
In most cases confronted with that situation, the officer's concern is to ameliorate the threat. And if that means effectuate an immediate arrest, the probable cause of which can be reviewed with colder heads at a later time, then they're going to effectuate the arrest to make sure that something doesn't escalate.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a unique problem that we see in domestic violence cases. Not all of these cases are going to result in viable prosecutions. But at the police level, at the prosecutor level, and then when it gets to the courtroom level, there needs to be careful discretion, not automatic results, as you've suggested in the hypothetical. And it's the lack of careful discretion here in the courts below that I believe raises this case to the need to have Supreme Court review. So unless there's any further questions, I have exhausted my time.
Thank you. Ms. Moran.
May it please the court, Susan Moran, on behalf of Mr. Ginley. If I may share some of my time with amicus, I would like to reserve that for that purpose. The threshold issue before this court is, did the Court of Appeals abuse its discretion in failing to grant leave for the state of Ohio to appeal an interlocutory motion in limine, which effectively was a correct ruling? Secondarily, the review is, did the trial court abuse its discretion? We've been a bit led off course as to what is properly before us. What happened was the state of Ohio appealed simultaneously both a 12K appeal, essentially asserting that its case would have been frustrated absent the testimony of the alleged victim. They simultaneously appealed a discretionary appeal, effectively arguing the same merits. The Court of Appeals denied both. What the state has before you is an underlying argument that the 8th District never reviewed. There was never a formal briefing for the Court of Appeals to render a decision, and there was never discussion. Ultimately, what the state is asking you to do is to rewrite Evidence Rule 614. Evidence 614 is quite specific in what is proper and what is improper. The heart of what the state of Ohio is saying to you is that because we don't like what this alleged victim is going to say on trial, we want to introduce a more favorable hearsay statement and impeach her with that, thereby submitting it as substantive evidence for the finder of fact. There lies many concerns with that procedure. Most importantly, confusion on the part of the fact finder.
If I understand your argument, the state took two appeals from the trial court's decisions, am I right?
You are correct, Your Honor.
And the Court of Appeals dismissed the first, and then it held, and that matter wasn't appealed to us.
Correct, the 12K, Your Honor.
And the second was dismissed as moot based on the finding that the first case had been dismissed, and that's what's on appeal to us.
Your Honor, there is...
Is that right, procedurally?
Procedurally, that is correct. I would offer some clarification, however. The word moot was utilized by the 8th District without clarification regarding what they intended by the word moot.
Okay.
I've advanced a couple theories as to why they utilized that term.
We don't really know.
However, I would like to draw the court's attention to the fact that 10 days after the 8th District denied the discretionary appeal, the state of Ohio filed a motion for reconsideration, effectively now presenting a third opportunity for the Court of Appeals to review the arguments, and the Court of Appeals denied leave yet again. So the Court of Appeals had three opportunities to review the advancements of the state of Ohio and had continually denied them.
Putting those procedural arguments aside, should we take a look at the substantive issue in this case because courts need guidance? Or is your opinion that the rule can never be used in a recantation of a witness?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that it's proper for this court to make that leap. I don't think that the state of Ohio has complied with the Ohio appellate rules and all the mandates that would properly...
I understand that's your position. I said putting that aside.
Okay, putting that aside. Your Honor, I think that, to be quite frank with you, I certainly believe that the proposition of law as advanced by the state of Ohio is as true as it is inapplicable to this case, because I don't believe that the trial judge made the advancement that the state of Ohio would like you to believe it made.
If you don't think the trial court required a threat?
I do not.
And you don't think, and you think that the proper way to deal with something like this is to file perjury charges against a victim?
I'm glad you bring that up, Your Honor, because I believe that Mr. Meyer is incorrect. In fact, I know Mr. Meyer is incorrect because I personally, as a criminal defense lawyer, have defended women who had at one time been victims and now have been defendants because of their changing of stories. So quite frankly, it is a problem, and it is something
that... But you do concede that in many, many cases, women recant for reasons other than the truth.
Certainly.
Potential abuse continuing, intimidation. I mean...
There is no doubt.
I was a trial judge, saw it a lot.
Seen it.
Couldn't believe the recantations. What is the tool that the prosecutor can use that you think is the legal, legitimate tool in dealing with a recantation?
Well, I think as Justice O'Donnell spoke on, there are other witnesses, quite frankly.
Okay, let's say no witnesses.
Well, Your Honor, I guess what you're asking me is, should we ignore the United States Constitution in Crawford v. Washington? And I think we should not, because we've gone to great lengths to have constitutional protections to confront a witness. And I think what the state of Ohio here is asking you to do is ignore
that. But you're
that.
Talking, Crawford says there's no witness. Here, they're asking to produce the witness, so you have a confrontation. You have the ability to cross-examine the witness on her changing stories and prove to the jury that her current recantation is the correct truth.
But you're crossing.
It's not an absent witness. It's trying to get the witness to the jury.
Certainly, Your Honor. However, you are cross-examining her with an impermissible document. You're cross-examining her with impermissible hearsay that, quite frankly, is
prior consistent statement. Why is that not admissible? You admit them all the time in witness statements.
Actually, I think the state of Ohio has conceded that it is impermissible hearsay and that to be utilizing it in that manner is effectively submitting it as substantive evidence, because that's ultimately what you're asking us to do, to say, although you were telling us here on the stand that this did not happen, isn't it true in an out-of-court statement you said just the opposite? And then we're with the finder of fact with two conflicting stories, and you're effectively asking the finder of fact to rely on the out-of-court statement as substantive evidence. That's the danger.
Ms. Moran, is there any way that a rule could be rewritten to address the problem of recanting witnesses in a domestic violence case?
Perhaps, Your Honor. I think that the pitfalls are, however, the hearsay and the Crawford issues that are tantamount, or that definitely accompany writing a rule of that nature.
Counsel, if the evidence, if these documents, these statements, let's just say statements that have been reduced to documents, fall under the 911 call, a police statement, excited utterance, furtherance of investigation, ongoing emergency, medical treatment, those are all exceptions.
They are,
and
Your
they
Honor.
Can be used to question a witness that is brought under 614.
Absolutely.
So it's not a universal concession by opposing counsel that you can't use an out-of-court statement in order to cross-examine a 614 witness.
You are correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
What we are dealing with specifically is an impermissible hearsay statement, as the state has conceded.
In this particular case.
Yes, Your
but
Honor.
That's not a universal application or statement. The types of statements that I just mentioned are very useful.
Absolutely, and there's no Crawford problem, Your Honor, with those,
right,
because those have the reliability of truthfulness in light of the circumstances in which they were produced, which is not what we have here.
Ms. Moran, to go back to your point about the fact that this case should be improvidently allowed based on the determination of the Court of Appeals as mootness, and the court hasn't passed on this issue. On review of the transcript from the trial court, the trial court indicates, in conclusion, the state has produced no evidence of threats from the defendant to the alleged victim or her family. That would seem to indicate that the court was relying on the fact that there wasn't any evidence of a threat, and therefore no reason for the court to even consider calling the victim as a court witness. Why shouldn't we ask the Court of Appeals to look at that and consider whether or not they abuse their discretion in failing to look at that as a basis for affirming the decision of the trial court in connection with the motion made under Evidence Rule 614?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that the 8th District did look at the advancements made by the state and quite thoroughly reviewed whether or not there were errors committed by the court. And
there was no oral argument, was there?
There was no oral argument, but there were motions.
There was a motion made, and the court dismissed the case as moot.
Well, there was a motion made for leave to file a discretionary appeal, and that was denied. And I would suggest to the court that the Court of Appeals had three opportunities to review the reasons why the state wanted a discretionary
appeal.
What
if we find that the Court of Appeals abused its discretion by not even considering what the state is trying to advance, that the trial court relied on some basis that doesn't appear in Evidence Rule 614 as part of its decision in this case?
Then you would remand this case back to the 8th District for consideration. If I may yield the balance of my time at this juncture.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin?
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, John Martin on behalf of the amicus. I thank the court for its indulgence in allowing me to argue this morning. Several points need to be addressed or supplemented, if I may. First, in this particular case, the trial court did not say that a threat was a requirement. Prior to the trial court's statements at the end of the hearing, at page 14, beginning at line 1, the court said, the court did indicate that it would be helpful to the state's motion if there was any indication that the defendant had a hand in the alleged victim's change of heart. The court categorically denies making any statement regarding the level or type of proof necessary to ensure a successful motion or that would preclude granting the motion.
Then why did the court contradict itself at the end when it said that the state hadn't produced that kind of evidence?
Your Honor, I think that that last statement comes on the heels of what the court says at page 15, where it says, as for your last point, referring to the prosecutor, as I stated earlier, the court is not forcing the state to produce any particular type of proof in support of this motion. There is no particular type of proof necessary. There is no bright line test. At that point, the trial court goes on to talk about the fact that there was the case of State versus Curry. And Curry had noted that it was helpful to determine in that case whether or not there had been a situation where the witness is fearful. And it was after that that the court made its comments about finally in conclusion. A fair reading, I would suggest, of that entirety of the transcript, with all due respect to the state, is that what the court is saying is, especially when you preclude it, or when you anticipate these other statements with the fact that the court had also noted that I've got a witness who has obtained her own counsel, is receiving now advice from an officer of the court, and the court doesn't put it quite that way, that's my interpretation. But when you take all of that together, what the trial court is saying is, one of the factors that I have to think about is, was there a threat? It is a factor, but it is not a prerequisite.
Well, counsel, did the trial court actually start out saying, why should I grant this? I've never granted one in 10 or 15 years, whatever it is that this judge has been asked to rule on these type of cases?
It is true that in chambers, the judge made a what he described himself as a flip remark with respect to that in jest.
But it was a truthful statement.
No, Your Honor, I would submit to the court that it is not. At page 12, line 11, he says, the truth is I have ordered witnesses to court, but it's always been on a case-by-case basis. And after you indicated that you were having trouble with this witness, and after I personally observed the witness show up to court with counsel in tow, I told you to file a motion and I would look at the issue. He mentions the fact that when he made that statement in chambers, that everybody laughed at the time, or, you know, at the idea that he had never done that before. No one's laughing at the seriousness of the allegation. I don't mean to suggest that. But he made the comment that basically, I made a comment in jest. He said to the prosecutor, look, in the future, I'm not going to make any more comments in jest in your presence, because obviously you have taken it in a different way than was intended. And he had even noted the fact that the trial judge saying to the prosecutor, my recollection is that you smiled when we were talking about that, and that this is being taken, in effect, out of context. So first and foremost, this judge did not set up a rule. That's number one. Number two, as to the question of the admissibility of that prior statement to the police, it is admissible for impeachment purposes, but not for the truth of the matter asserted. Accordingly, if a witness gets up on the stand and says, this never happened, and the prosecutor says on cross-examination, did you not tell the police that this did happen? And the witness says, yes, I did tell the police that. And that's all the evidence that comes in. The Rule 29 has to be granted. because there has been substantive evidence, the viva voce testimony on the stand, it did not happen, and evidence that can only be considered for impeachment, that cannot stand on its own as substantive evidence that it did happen, that doesn't count. A Rule 29 has to be granted.
Does that then make the 614 motion final and appealable?
Your Honor, as a matter of in mid-trial, that would not make the 614 rule final and appealable. One of the aspects of it is this: mid-trial, you do not have here an exclusion or suppression of evidence. The witness is testifying. Nobody has said that this victim, alleged victim.
The state has as much as admitted that if we are unable to call this person as a court witness, we will be unable to cross-examine the witness, given the witness's recantation, and therefore we are effectively precluded, and as you've argued effectively, an acquittal must be granted. Therefore, what opportunity has the state to appeal an acquittal?
Chief None. Justice, I'm sorry, Go Chief ahead. Justice O'Connor, I see that my time has ended. May I have leave?
Go ahead.
Thank you. First, the state is not precluded from, nothing in this judge's order has said the state cannot cross-examine this witness. Evidence Rule 611, not 614, is the rule that concerns the mode and interrogation of witnesses. 611 says that the trial court has the discretion, and no one's asked the trial judge to exercise that discretion yet, to allow the state to lead this alleged victim in the course of testimony. That's
and
number
your
one.
Your point is they could have called her as their own witness.
Yes, they still can, Your Honor. They still can, Your Honor, except for the fact that they've certified to the Court of Appeals, which raises a different issue that's not before this court, that they can't go forward in this case. But secondly,
if they call her as their own, impeach their own witness, can they?
You cannot impeach your own witness with a prior statement, Your Honor, under 607.
So calling her as their witness, if she says those statements are false, that's the end of that, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, if she says those statements are false as a matter of substantive evidence, that's the end of it, no matter who has called this witness, because that prior statement to the police officer cannot come in for the truth of the matter asserted. The 801.
You don't think the state can impeach her as a court witness and cross-examine her using those statements?
Even if you impeach under 614, the 614 rule that allows the witness to be called as a court's witness does not override in any way the 801 requirement that an out-of-court statement cannot be offered for the truth of the matter asserted, with one exception which goes to the issue of what can a prosecutor do. We don't need a new rule, respectfully. The state has not availed itself in this case, as is the common practice in Cuyahoga County, of one possible way to have been able to preserve testimony that could have been offered for its truth, regardless of who calls the witness. Have a preliminary hearing and call the alleged victim as a witness at the preliminary hearing. Under 801D, if the witness gives an inconsistent statement, not to the police officer, but one that was under oath, subject to cross-examination, then at that point, it falls into that portion of 801 which says, hearsay is an out-of-court statement offered for its truth, but then we have that hole in the middle of the donut that says, but we're not going to consider these things as hearsay. And that is available to the state. So in the end.
But if she's on the stand in a preliminary hearing examination for probable cause.
Yes.
And she denies it at that point.
Yes.
You still can't use that statement.
You can't use the prior statement from the city of whichever police department
right.
happens to be.
Right.
You cannot use that statement for the truth of the matter asserted, but the preliminary hearing has occurred within the first 10 or 15 days since
before
arrest.
She can be infected with the recantation bug. She'll tell the truth on a a preliminary hearing, but she then has time to reflect and change her story for the trial.
Your Honor, I'm not willing to concede that the recantation in this situation is not a matter of this woman telling the truth. This woman has talked to a lawyer, consulted with counsel, has an officer of the court that insulates her not only from the defendant in this case, but also gives her advice as to her responsibilities and her duties, and then still says, what I said to the police was not true. This court should not assume, as has the state, that she's necessarily lying when she does all this in a long statement after having been taught, or in any statement after having consulted with counsel.
And how many separate police reports were there in the case, Mr. Martin? Do you know? Right, 4 or 5?
Your Honor, the police reports are attached to the state's motion at State's Exhibit 4. There are several reports, but they concern one statement by the alleged victim in this case. You have a situation here where you have one police officer who's arresting the defendant, another police officer who's talking to the alleged victim in the case. So there are several reports, but this is not a situation where she gave multiple statements.
There were multiple episodes beginning on New Year's Eve up through April, am I right?
There are reports from her of multiple episodes over time, including one that had occurred.
And each of those was denied as false.
She has given a statement through counsel that what she has said is false. I don't know that she has detailed, Your Honor, and I don't know that it's in the record at this point that she has detailed specifically this statement was false or that statement was false. There are hearsay exceptions in certain cases. Not so much course of the investigation, because when we talk about evidence that comes, statements that come in for the course of the investigation, they're not offered for their truth. They're offered to show why the officer took the next step. A limiting instruction needs to be given in that situation. But in some circumstances, there may be other hearsay exceptions. Not necessarily medical reports, because this is going to the identity of the person who caused the injury. We're not willing to concede any of those things. But the point is this. A trial judge who holds the hearing that was held here, who listens, who reviews the rulings, who goes through and talks about factors, but never says, I have to have a threat, has not abused its discretion. And the 8th District certainly has not abused its discretion when confronted with this kind of transcript in declining to hear this case. Did they use the term moot? Yes. Was that the correct term? No. But abuse of discretion has always been broad enough to forgive slight misstatements along those lines. And when the state then comes back and says, wait a minute, we have this discretionary appeal we really want you to look at, and the court considers that motion for reconsideration and then simply says denied, not denied as moot, just simply says denied, at that point, what more can a court do to say, we don't want this case? And you can still call your witness. You just can't do it as with the court's imprimatur.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer.
Your Honor, with leave of the court, I'd like to briefly sum up. The state's appeal in this case concerning the 8th District, the 8th District suggested through its declaration of mootness that only 12K appeals are proper in a pretrial setting as in this case, and that is not Ohio law. And it's that declaration of mootness, which I'm saying is an error of law, but more fundamentally is an example of the type of treatment in the courts below that is diametrically opposed to what this court said in Bush should happen. And so I will fully concede that at a trial of the issue in this case, the defendant may be found not guilty. These allegations may in fact be false. What I am asking this court to do is to announce a proposition of law, and I believe that is in order here, that the state at least has the tool to attempt to obtain the truth after the trial court exercises careful discretion. And it is that reason alone that we have brought this case, not as an intellectual exercise to test the limits of the state statutory right of appeal.
So you, getting back to what you would have us write or instruct the trial court with use with regard to use of a 614 rule, it would be, well, you tell me, what would you want us to say?
that the trial court should evaluate whether the court's witness rule will assist the fact finder in deriving the truth and should not consider a threat.
And if so, that mandates that the witness be called?
If the trial court, in its discretion, after careful review, like we have described in Bush, decides that it will assist the fact finder in determining the truth, yes, it should exercise its discretion.
Won't every potential witness assist the trial court in ascertaining the truth or the jury?
Certainly, if the state is limited to its manner of examination, as in this case, where the state is precluded from examining on the prior statement, then no, the truth will not be in front of the fact finder. The state will be precluded in its ability to examine the truth in fairness to both parties. So that is why the application in this case, the threat criteria, is not just improper, but it is bad policy in domestic violence cases. And that is why we have asked the Supreme Court to get involved at this juncture. And I would ask not only that this court reverse and modify the 8th District's opinion, but to announce that very clear proposition of law to give us the tools to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter will be taken under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.